Broadcasting. Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. Tonight is June 7th, 2012. Last week, after my own show, I was a guest the first hour on Coast to Coast AM with host George Norrie. And that was rather interesting because I was in the studio in Los Angeles. With a live interview. So that was a lot of fun, being in the studio with producer Tom Danheiser, and then George. A lot of energy, let me put it that way. When you're live in the studio, it's quite a bit different than doing an interview remotely when I'm in, say, my own studio. And there's a lot of chemistry between talk show hosts and the guests, especially when, like in Coast to Coast, I've been a guest there for just about forever, it seems. And but being live in the studio, it's really interesting. George autographed for me his latest book entitled Talking to the Dead. So once again, that's interesting. And also, just an interesting experience doing. I was in Los Angeles for a number of reasons, and so I went and did some of the standard things. For example, the La Brea Tar Pits, something that amazes me. It's always amazed me that, and so I listened to some of the tour guides and went around and saw the sites. But one thing, sometimes it's just serendipity or you're in the right place at the right time. So I heard one of the tour guys saying that the animals were all dismembered. Now, they have amazing artifacts of these animals, the skeletons that were preserved of the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tiger and the wolves. There were hundreds of wolves in the tar pits there. And the tar pits are still oozing. It's amazing. And, of course, that whole area was one of the early oil centers, oil-gathering areas of the country. But, as I've always said before, do you think all those animals were so stupid, all of these hundreds and hundreds of animals, that they all just walked into this and died and drowned in this oil? And the scenarios that they give are so ridiculous for these animals dying in these tar pits. Now, you know, you could imagine maybe one or two. There was the remains of a woman in there, and they talk about them going out and falling in. The stench from these pools is horrendous, from the oil, etc. And I can't really believe any animal would walk in there. But the interesting part is that the animals, all of their parts were in the bones, let's say, were in the pits, but they were all scattered all over the place. So when they did excavations, they dug up, and maybe part of a mastodon was over here and another part over there, and they were able to reassemble all of these with great time and effort. And they're still going through this. There's still a laboratory there that's examining the remains in the tar pits. So it's an ongoing effort. But the scenario that standard science gives, of course, is that these animals were all so stupid, thousands of them, that they just walked into these tar pits and died. And, of course, the real scenario is that over the years, and this is something that had to have happened too, the rain of brimstone and fire, as Venus came around time after time after time, with the inferior conjunction, and of course we just had a Venus inferior conjunction, so it's very interesting. A lot of people learned a lot of details about the inferior conjunction of Venus. But when Venus was the great comet, as it was becoming a planet, say every 3, 4, 5 years it would come around and swoop close to Earth, and Earth would be bathed in the tail of Venus. That's when Venus was a comet, and working its way in to become the planet that we see today. So we would have been bathed with hydrocarbons, rain, and this would have diminished every time it happened. It would have got less and less and less. because Venus was very well in the ecliptic plane, becoming a planet. So at any rate, that gives you a very good scenario for the end of that Holocene period when the mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers died, and with the flooding and the hydrocarbons washing in to this area. The scenarios given by Standard Science, they look good with animations, they look good with the textbooks, the pictures, but they don't add up in reality. The standard story is this oil just oozes up out of the ground from down deep and causes the pools. Well, where did the oil come from? They always miss some of these major points, and they kind of gloss over them. And I got a kick out of the tour guide saying that they really didn't know. They didn't know where this the tar pits came from, and they didn't know a lot of detail about these scenarios or how the bones got completely separated. And they give some sing-song ideas of how this may have happened, but at any rate, just real interesting. Let's see, some other things that I did while there. I visited the Griffith Observatory. Now, this was a special, I don't know if you'd call it treat, but eye-opener for me. The Griffith Observatory, of course, along with the Wilson Observatory, is right in the Los Angeles area there. These were donated and built early in the 1900s to advance astronomy. These were donations by people. And that gives a very interesting view of how science was back then. Government was not that involved in science. But the point is, in listening to tour guides there, and also they had two or three programs where you go into the planetarium. They have a planetarium where, of course, you go in and you sit like a theater, and the seats recline, and you look up to the domed ceiling. They are so preoccupied with 2012. You cannot go 1 minute in that observatory without somebody saying how important 2012 is and how important it is that nothing's going to happen, how ridiculous 2012 is. And so it's very clear to me now that we're in 2012 and this scenario is unfolding, that the whole 2012 thing was set up as a massive disinformation campaign. So what happens? Oh, many years ago, very shortly after the 2003 May 15th Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, Planet X is supposed to come and destroy Earth, and of course that never happened, at that point they started already planning the 2012 disaster, world's going to end on the 21st, Nostradamus, all of these scenarios. And now we're in 2012, so that gives the platform. And boy, the professional astronomers can't laugh enough, and that crazy, all that conspiracy theory out there, and all of these goofy people. Don't worry, folks, the world's going to be here. So what it does, it gives them a crazy story that was created, and goofy as can be, and of course, there's nothing to it. So that gives astronomers a platform to come in, the white horses, march in and save the day, and group all of those crazy conspiracy theories into one big pile and denounce them. But in doing so, then the public is force-fed the Big Bang, and that nothing is going to happen. Nothing has happened in the past. Nothing's going to happen in the future. And, of course, what I'm concentrating on lately are the physics of ancient disasters, where I go in piece by piece and talk about ancient disasters. By the way, the main science topic tonight, I will be talking about two questions that came up on the Coast to Coast show. A woman called in and asked about the visible comet for 40 years while the Israelites had wandered through the desert. This is the Moses event. They had wandered through the desert for a period of 40 years, And so the comet was visible during that whole time. They talk about it. So the question, her question was, isn't that a bit long for a comet to exist in the solar system? Because typically you see them for a day or a week or something like that. Hale-Bopp was up there for 6 years. Well, Hale-Bopp had a 2,500-year orbit when it left. It came in with a 4,200-year orbit. And I should say Hale-Bopp left with a 2,600-year orbit. But that was an orbit which allowed it to be visible in the solar system, and it was a fairly decent comet. It wasn't the monster comets of old. And, of course, remember that comets are relative. If we would have come much closer to Hale-Bopp, it would have looked big in the sky. It didn't look big because we weren't that close. So big, in the terms of the ancients, was relative. It's big because it looked big. So that was one question, and I'll be talking about that during the main science topic of this show. The other one is, and it was a great question. I love listener questions because they get down to specific points that I want to enumerate on and go deeper into these topics. He said in the old texts, when the Israelites talk about it was in the sky. It's out clearly in the sky. And, of course, the sky is the atmosphere or above them. They didn't have scientific knowledge of what comets were. Remember that Aristotle thought comets were in the atmosphere. He thought it was some kind of fire phenomenon up in the atmosphere. And it was Kepler who learned that by calculations and understanding orbits, he learned that the comets were out there, out amongst the planets, and that the planets were out there. Up until the Middle Ages, they thought that there was a firmament, and the stars were glued onto the firmament, this big dome above Earth, and that the planets and the sun moved across. They still had that old Greek-Roman view of the heavens. So it wouldn't be unusual that the ancients talk about what they saw in the sky, but not understanding that it was a comet, it was out there, and what all of these things were happening to them. That's why I'm trying to clarify this today. And remember that standard science, by virtue of having ridiculous fairy tale science, say that nothing happened. There was no event out there. Nothing happened. And so they basically discount the most important events in history that developed man, that caused the last great extinction, all within recorded history. But the person's question was a man that called in, and I'm sorry I don't remember the name, but it was a real good question. He said that the story said by day it was a cloud of smoke in the sky, and by night it was a light stick in the sky, a stick of light, basically, that guided their way. It illuminated the land so they could see. So how could that be, that it's smoke by day and a stick of fire by night? Anyway, I will be talking about that. But back to the La Brea Tar Pits, back to Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. Wow, I was absolutely amazed that the level of these people just can't say enough about how goofy 2012 is, and don't worry about it, the world's all going to be here next year, on and on and on. At any rate, it became very clear to me, and of course the public is there, 99% of them scooping all of this up, and that's what was planned to do. The plan was to fool the public, and they're successful, I have to admit. If you look at standard science with its phony information, with its phony theories, and then all of the professional astronomers all standing in a row, you know. And then I went to, also, there was a lecture, and it happens the first Friday of every month. So that was June 1st. It happened to fall on a Friday, and I happened to be there, so I went to that once again. Every other statement was, ha, 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 2012, how ridiculous. All those goofy people, don't listen to that. And so astronomers are very, very preoccupied with telling you that there's nothing to 2012, and of course there isn't. There never was. But it's a good example of a pre-constructed disinformation campaign, which gives a platform for the professional astronomers to come riding in on their white horses and save the day, but in the process bundling everything, including my work, into the process. But here is something that's really, really interesting. Okay, so we're at the lecture at the Griffith Observatory, Friday night, June 1st, and the head of the observatory gets up. And he's a very humorous guy. He has a lot of humor in his oration. And so he's going through his talk, and they're talking about going out and looking at the transit of Venus, which is, of course, going to happen at that point, was going to happen the next Tuesday, which happened the other day. And I'll be talking a little bit here about the transit of Venus also. But at any rate, in his talk about going out and searching for the transit of Venus and doing some photography work and leading a team out into the field to look at it, he comes up and he says he's an expert in Southwest American rock art. And I'm like, oh boy, we got a professional who thinks he's a rock art expert. That's great. So he's going through some pictures of some of the Southwest American artwork. And so then he comes along and he's describing this star-shaped petroglyph, Indian rock painting. A petroglyph is more of a carving in a rock. So I believe this was more of a Indian artwork with paint. But at any rate, here it is. It's like a star with big wings on it and a tail, very clearly a tail. Not a massive giant tail, but still very clearly a tail. And so he's going through that this is the cause of war and cause of famine and cause of all kinds of calamity in the human history of the Native Indians of that area, the Native Americans of that area. And I shouldn't say Indians, because remember that Columbus thought he discovered India, so they called them Indians. And that's, of course, completely wrong. So what I should be saying is the Native Americans of that area, the indigenous people in the American Southwest. And, of course, then at the end, I just about fell off my chair. He goes, and that represents the planet Venus. And he said it real fast, and he kept going. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. Here's the professional astronomer, rock art, indigenous rock art expert, and he comes across something and the native people tell him that this represents Venus. It's very clearly a comet, and he makes no comment about this at all. So just rather comical when listening to this and watching these people gloss over the obvious. Let me quick comment about the transit of Venus. The transit of Venus only happens every few hundred years, and I'm not going to go through the detail, but it's very much a pattern, and this is due to the fact that Venus's orbit is inclined to the orbit of Earth, and so many times when the inferior conjunction of Venus happens, Venus is down below the Sun or above the Sun, so we don't get a transit. A transit is when Venus actually crosses the solar disk, and it can be seen, the shadow, so to speak, of Venus. In the early days, Galileo and the early astronomers, the people that were watching the Sun, were able to use this to calculate the distance to the Sun. They devised an experiment. Once they realized the Venus transit thing was going on, they devised an experiment where one person got very far away on one part of the Earth, and then another person measured the transit on another point on the Earth, and the parallax, the difference in the angle and the position of Venus moving across the Sun, was sufficient for them to measure and calculate the distance to the sun. They really didn't have a good handle on that. And of course, that's a non-factor today because we have other methods of measuring the distance to the sun. Much more exact, many other more exact methods of measuring the distance to the sun. We have satellites out there that give us an angle on the sun, measuring the sun's diameter, measuring the other properties of the sun, and also giving us very exact distance to the sun. We know the sun's mass. If we did not know these, satellites moving in outer space would not be possible. We wouldn't have enough information to send satellites to other planets. So, and of course, the sun is the, once you get out into away from the Earth, the sun is the dominant mass in the solar system. So you better know the mass of the sun. You better know the distance to the sun. You better know a lot of properties about the sun, and you better know the distance to the other planets to calculate orbits and of say spacecraft going out to the other planets or whatever. You're going to lose your spacecraft. So clearly, modern science has many new, better ways to measure the distance to the sun. But the transit of Venus was the old method back in the Middle Ages of measuring the distance to the sun. So that's a very interesting property of the transit. Now, the data being collected gives astronomers a view of the atmosphere of Venus and the properties of the atmosphere of Venus, because we're seeing that solar light, which we already know what the properties of solar light are, and so shining through the atmosphere of Venus gives us a chance to measure the properties of the atmosphere of Venus. So at any rate, that happened this past week. Also, just the fact that we had an inferior conjunction of Venus, you might notice people around this time, this period of time right now, in fact, because the tail of Venus kind of lags behind. It's not in a direct like line out to Earth. And so when we pass through that, and this is in the medical journals, the incidence of flu goes up. It's a type of flu that apparently starts in, they call it swine flu because it starts in pigs. They're most susceptible to it. Then it is transferred to birds. The virus mutates and birds become susceptible, and then especially chickens, the kind of birds that are around people, and then that mutates to the kind of flu that affects people. So sometimes it's called bird flu, sometimes it's called swine flu. I get a kick out of the term they used to use when I was a kid. That was called the Russian flu, as if it was some kind of Russian Cold War conspiracy or something. But at any rate, right now, there may be people getting sick, especially in areas where it's raining a lot, because what happens is it comes down out of the atmosphere in the rain. A lot of tropical regions where it rains a lot, you get this. So I wanted to get back to the Griffith Observatory to just give you a concept of how much time and effort they are putting into denouncing 2012. One of the shows concentrated on time and it's kind of the end of the world scenarios. So it starts out, and this is all animation. So somebody put some serious money and some serious time into this animation. You're sitting in your chair in the Griffith Observatory in the planetarium, and the lights go dim, and it comes out, and there's a scenery, a beautiful scenery on a beach. It looks like Florida. And there's Ferris wheels in the background. Okay, everything is serene and calm, and all of a sudden, here comes an asteroid out of the sky, and it crashes. Now there's 1, 2, 3, 4 asteroids that crash into Earth, and fires are, and you hear the sirens going in the background. Okay, then all of a sudden, out of the sky starts to appear a planet, a big round planet, and it crashes into the moon and basically absorbs the moon, and all of a sudden monkeys start flying into the atmosphere all over, and then they stop it, and then the voice comes out, this woman goes, wait a minute, what's going on here? And so they reverse it all and come back and tell you how ridiculous all of these theories are of 2012 and the Mayan calendar, and then they debunk the concept that the Mayan calendar has anything to do with 2012, which is true. But who made up the story? And, of course, the astronomers are too stupid to figure out that this was all a constructed misinformation campaign. And they're just like the other side of the story coming in. Tier 2 scientists giving you Tier 2 science, totally incorrect, bogus science. And, of course, they get their paycheck, just like the head of the Griffith Observatory comes in and looks at an Indian rock painting. He's supposed to be an expert. It's in the shape of a giant comet. Here's Venus, the comet. He glosses over it like nothing ever happened and keeps going. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know that the animation at the beginning of the planetarium show is this, you know, to fill that whole planetarium with animation, 3D type animation, is that didn't just happen overnight. Some little grad student sitting in his office didn't sit there and animate that. This took serious money, serious time, and so somebody spent some serious effort to put this information out and for the whole public. And of course, a lot of people see this and then they go home. There's little kids there and moms and dads and visitors and tourists from other countries. This is the message coming out of standard science. Anyway, I won't dwell on that, but it was just important to see, and we're going to see a lot more of that standard science marching out, having a platform to talk about how ridiculous 2012 is. And I'll tell you more about that in the future. There's some things that I did while I was in Los Angeles, and this kind of a battle going on. And of course, they're doing anything they can do to make me look ridiculous or anybody else that's putting out real information. It's kind of subtle, but they have a little problem with me. I don't depend on them or their advertising or their little government checks or whatever. I say things the way I see them, and also I can talk to the public. I can talk to the public and give you information and reasons for why things are the way they are. The political scene mixed in. So life is very complex today, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So that's part of what I'm doing, is educating the public on all these fronts. I quickly wanted to comment on the Queen's coronation. And, of course, many, many people watched this. I have to, I just get a kick out of the English people. They are so enthralled with the Queen. And I know there's a lot of people in England that I've talked to that are not enthralled with the Queen. So this grandiose display of the support for the Queen, they said there were about 1 million people there, and of course everybody likes a parade, and an event that only would happen during their lifetime, so there was a lot of interest in that. But behind the scenes, it looked like the Rose Day Parade or something, but on a grand, grand scale. 1,000 ships coming down the Thames River, and with the Queen and all of that stuff. To me, the Queen represents the banking interests of Europe, and that's exactly what it is. All of the gold that they sit on, and that's what it is, that the power comes from the gold they're sitting on, all of that was stolen from the New World. England, at the time all of the expeditions to the New World started after the Columbus discovery of America, and in a sense, yeah, Columbus did, for those people, discovered America. They were not aware that Leif Erikson and his band of merry Vikings came to the New World and discovered it. So in terms of time, yeah, the Vikings were here a lot earlier, and there were a lot of groups of people that were here before the Vikings were. So who really discovered America? And there were a lot of indigenous people living here before, so they discovered it. You know, who was the original discoverer? One could argue a lot about those points. But in terms of Europe and the expansionism of Europe, Columbus, in a sense, yeah, I would say he discovered and brought back the information and started that big movement into the Americas. And what was one of the biggest things that happened? They, number one, they destroyed the cultures. They burned and they killed, and there were, you know, probably hundreds of millions of indigenous people in the Americas at that time, and they were all killed. They died off and went into hiding. We know the Incas went into hiding. The Maya had remnants there. Their golden period had already ended, but there were still lots of Mayans there. But the biggest thing is that the Spanish came, they destroyed the culture and stole all the gold. They did not leave a rock unturned. However, I've heard, and a lot of people have evidence, that the Incas have tremendous amounts of gold in still hidden in South America. But the point is that they filled galleons, ships, big ships, full of gold. And just to give you a scale, near Dominican Republic, the majority of that boat traffic went through what's called the Mona Channel, currently called the Mona Channel, between Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic. And a lot of boats sank there, but the vast majority of the boats didn't sink. They got back to Spain. And just around the Dominican Republic alone, there are 26 major shipments of gold that went down, that are on the rocks there, actually being protected by the Dominican Republic government and not allowing any grave robbers, so to speak, to go out there and dive on these ships. And of course, it's in very rough open sea water where these ships are. But 26 ships filled with gold still on the bottom, but that does not, I should say, that does speak of the amount of gold that actually got through. So the wealth of the Rothschilds, the wealth of the Crown of England, all depends on the gold that was stolen from the indigenous Americas. So that's my comment on the Queen. They believe, too, they still own the colonies. The colonies were still the colonies. Wow. To them, she ain't my queen. I don't have any interest in all of that. And if you look at the, I won't go into my other opinions about the queen. All I'm going to say is she ain't my queen. Okay, another topic to talk about. The X company, X Space Company, SpaceX, put a payload, took an actual payload out to the International Space Station. So the first public, or what you might call private non-government, trip to the space station was accomplished this week, and was a very historic event. Of course, this is the kind of thing that should have been happening long ago, but, of course, you would imagine that I have a few criticisms of all of this. First of all, SpaceX is a company that plays by the rules, does all the stuff right. So they get the red, you know, the green, what do you call it, the green flag to go out there, the green light, gets all the government, everything is, the skids are greased for them. But what are they doing? They're using old rocket technology. They're using the stuff that really won't get us any place. They're putting time, effort into supporting basically an old tin can out there. I think in one sense it's a great achievement, but in the other sense it shows how they are following down the same road. They basically tier two the rocket technology, the space station technology that will not get us as a civilization anywhere, misdiverting our resources from what really should be going on in outer space. Also, there's a new XPRIZE that is being donated. And I always wonder, you know, these people are very successful for a reason. As I said, the people, the owners of these companies. But they play the game. They play that the monopoly game, right? Let's put it that way. There's a $30 million prize for a company that can go to the moon. There's rules like they have to drive around with a little vehicle. They have to explore, I think it's a 500-meter area, which is not real big. But in a sense, it's quite big, you know, if you're trying to send some little rover to the moon. But any private company that can do this will win a $30 million prize. And so there are, I guess, about 30 teams doing this. But here's the catch. Then everybody's underwear are visible, let's put it that way. The people who are developing technology to go into space jump on the bandwagon. They go, oh, let's quick do this. This we can get $30 million prize and notoriety and all the other things that go with it. But what else goes with it is the government being able to look at everything everybody's doing in terms of space development. Is that an incentive? Yeah, I think so. But I think that the people that are intelligent will just go off and do things on their own. And the Chinese, in fact, are doing that. The one thing I like to point out is that the Chinese are very advanced when it comes to outer space. And my estimate, if we go back once again with the analogy of the Middle Ages, let's go back and look at the who broke out of the pack, so to speak, in the Middle Ages. And it was Spain and England in the end, and the Spanish Armada came along and left England basically dominant, world dominant in the seas. So basically, whoever controlled the seas was the person that controlled the next 600 years of history, and that was England. And that's where we come today to the Queen being there. But of course, the Queen, if you look, is not the Queen of England. She's German. And so the whole monarchy, current reigning monarchy of England, is from Germany. This was an arrangement with the bankers. So once again, back to that banking interest, international interest. Anyway, that's a little bit of commentary on that subject. Let me see. Just one more comment. I went and did some other tourist things, and one of them was to visit the some energy facilities on the West Coast. It just is amazing our dependency on nuclear, especially in the West Coast areas like that. So coal, nuclear, and propane energy, it's absolutely imperative that we get off of these energy sources, and that's all I'm going to say about that subject. I've talked before about the alternative energy fields being controlled by the same entities that control major energy sources. And so that's something that for our future, for our well-being, we need to get off oil and gasoline for automobiles. We need electric cars. But it's just amazing how the Earth is being stifled. The planet Earth is being controlled to maintain those energy industries. And, of course, very early on in the 1900s, the people that controlled money, people that controlled the world, understood they had to control the energy sources. If you control the energy sources, you control the world. That's what's going on today. And also the gold, as I said, another resource that's becoming the equivalent of gold in this century, in the new millennium, is water, the control of water. And that is currently underway. And, of course, governments all over the world are facilitating the control of water. The thing, probably, besides air and water, those are the two essentials of life every day. They're coming under severe control on all fronts. Okay, on to the main science topic. I want to, by the way, there are so many things going on in the world today. I want to cover them on my show, but I also want to give serious time to the questions going back into ancient disasters and giving detailed information. So when I was on the Coast to Coast show, they had listener call-ins. And two of the questions, I already talked about this earlier. One of them, a woman called in, she says, oh, come on, 40 years, a comet in the sky, that's ridiculous. And so I wanted to go into that subject. I love listener questions because it gives me a platform to talk about. And the other one was, the guy said the ancient texts talk about the smoke in the sky, and then it became a stick of light at night. How did that happen? How is that explained? By the fact that it was Venus, the comet, the great comet Venus, that was working its way in to become the planet Venus that we see today. How did this add up into these legends? So first of all, we know from the Mayans that the incidents of Venus were 52 years apart, that Venus first interacted with Earth, and then 52 years later, it interacted again. We also know that the calendar changed. And by the way, that the Mayan calendar, supposedly, that most people are presenting today, the so-called internet wannabe experts, they're showing the Aztec calendar. It wasn't what people are showing today is the Mayan calendar is not the Mayan calendar at all. The ancient Mayan calendar had was based on the cycles of Venus. It had absolutely nothing to do with the sun and the moon, which is pretty strange because the most natural thing to use for a calendar would be the sun and the moon. But the Mayans finally solidified the orbit of Venus after Venus became a planet. And so they worked on this probably for hundreds of years. The reality is, and this is based on my calculations and also observations and reading ancient texts, is that it took about 600 years, not 40 years, but a total of about 600 years for Venus to become the planet we see today. And then it had many flare-ups during that time. We had many inferior conjunctions when the tail of Venus actually affected Earth, becoming less and less each time, and of course fading out in history with time. So the fact that, or the question, the woman's question, that could Venus, or how could Venus, the comet, spend 40 years in the solar system? Well, it was a permanent member of the solar system. It really was about 600 years. But remember, we see this through the eyes of the modern Maya, the Maya that lived around 800 AD to around 1300 AD, who had maintained the calendars and the traditions of thousands of years earlier, the mathematics, the writing system, and the gridwork on the temples. All of the Mayan discussion of Quetzalcoatl goes back to the Venus event. Venus and Quetzalcoatl are the same character in Mayan history. And of course, the Israelites did not turn into calendar makers. They didn't turn into astronomers necessarily. They were much closer to the Earth, let's say. But they still relate and confirm those stories. And this is one of the big things that you have to understand about these ancient events. Modern science, when you go to museums and stuff in ancient history, they gloss over this, and they have all kinds of pretty drawings, and the scenario of history looks great, this slow development of man, etc. But it doesn't add up. It doesn't add up under close scrutiny. They've done a good job of painting a glossy picture and putting it all in a nice little box for public consumption. The only trouble is it doesn't add up. And every time you try and look at it, at the real details, they stumble all over themselves. Like the Indian, Indian, I keep using that, kind of dates me. But the indigenous American Southwest painting of Venus with a tail, it's a star with a tail with wings, causes death and destruction, war, pestilence, famine. And how could Venus do that? It's just a little dot up in the sky. Well, Venus was different in history and within the history of these people. Somebody drew that picture and to recount those events. And of course, they really didn't understand any of this. They were just recording what was going on. Standard science now denies this. So could Venus the comet be in the solar system and visible for 40 years? Well, yes, it was. And it was actually visible for a lot longer than that, probably up to about 600 years, but the majority of that 600 years, it had already worked its way into the inner solar system and was not that big a deal. It became less and less an effect on Earth, and it took probably 200-300 years to solidify the calendar of Venus. Why were the ancients so preoccupied with Venus? Because it's the thing that came out and hammered Earth that caused the great destruction. So at any rate, that is a little bit of commentary on that woman's question. That was, by the way, on Coast to Coast. They had questions, listener call in, and that was one of the questions. The other question, which I thought was real interesting, and I really didn't have time. You have to understand, when you're doing live interviews like this, things are racing. You're racing the clock, you're coming up to advertisement breaks, and you have a lot of information. The host has questions, things, points he wants to make. So, but at any rate, all in all, I did not get to answer this question on the air on the Coast to Coast show, which happens. But so that what I'm going to do now, though, is pick that up and talk about, okay, so the Israelites, with the Moses story, talk about the cloud in the sky, and then at night it turned into a stick of light that guided their way. This is for 40 years as they wandered through the desert. Well, once again, that's a perfect description of the comet. We're talking about big comets, not the little powder puff Halley's Comet type. We're talking about the big ancient comets, the kind we have not seen. And frankly, I don't know if I'd really want to see one of those big comets. But the cloud of sky in the day, that's what Aristotle calls it. That's what the ancients saw. They saw, so if a comet is close enough and big enough, which Venus was, it would look like a cloud in the sky, actually visible in the day sky. I saw Hale-Bopp when it was here, and I remember going out on a February morning in the cold. It was, 40 below zero, but I wanted to go out, and there was a nice clear sky, so I went out to see Hale-Bopp, and the sun's rising, and it's getting light out, and there's Hale-Bopp in the sky. You could see it almost to the point where it was in the daylight, where you could still see Hale-Bopp. And so, and it was far away. It wasn't that bright a comet. But it was far away and not that big. So a much larger comet would be more visible and seen many times, especially when it's closer, as a cloud in the sky. So it dominated their existence. There it was. What is that thing up there? And if something were up there today, it would dominate our existence too. And that, my friends, is exactly what Standard Science is preparing. All of this 2012, all of this hype about Standard Science being right, and don't worry about that. Wow, were they preoccupied with that. And somebody's putting a lot of money into dumbing down the public so that they have no clue that they believe Standard Science. Give credibility to Standard Science, because if one of these babies shows up one day, believe me, everybody on the planet is going to be pointing and saying, what's that? And of course NASA is going to be doing their little dance like Pee Wee Herman, going, this is a dirty snowball, don't worry about that, it's the little dirty snowball. And at a certain point people are going to go, that ain't no little dirty snowball. That's something big, and then they're going to see it interacting with other planets. Electrical discharges, other effects in outer space. interacting with asteroids electrically, zapping out electrical discharges. The people are just going to go, ain't no snowball, NASA and standard science. But they're going to be out there, that newspaper, the nightly evening news, if one of these things shows up, a Planet X object, and it's going to look like a comet. And by the way, that's another thing in the scenario put together at the Griffith Observatory. What comes in? A big planet. And the moon crashes into it, and you see that big planet come in, and it looks like Jupiter or something. And so anyway, they want to portray that image, that Planet X, and all the crazies talking about Planet X are referring to a big planet-looking object. Don't talk about comets. When the head of the Griffith Observatory comes along and sees an Indian, and I'm saying it again, an indigenous American rock painting of Venus, that the local people say that's Venus, and it has a tail and wings, and it's clearly not just a little dot in the sky Venus, he just glosses over it. It's really comical to watch. Okay, so at any rate, back to the stick of fire. What is the stick of fire? It's pretty easy to understand that a cloud in the sky would look like a comet, but what's the stick of fire part of this? Well, the stick of fire is as follows. The comets are self-luminescent. In other words, they give off light that doesn't come from the sun. There again, standard science balks on this part of comet observations. Comet Hyakutake, one of the bluest comets ever seen, was very bright, luminosity. Astronomers were not allowed to talk about that. They were not allowed to talk about the fact that Hyakutake and Hale-Bopp were blue comets. And this is, by the way, one of the Hopi legends, that the blue comets are the dangerous ones. They're the ones that light up like a light bulb. Why do they light up like a light bulb? Because of the electrical discharge passing through the comet. In my comet model, the plasma discharge comet model, the electron beam coming out from the sun is the dominant charge carrier. It passes through the cloud of gases and dust associated with the comet, and it's like a big giant neon sign in the sky. So at night, why don't you see that in the daytime? Well, the atmosphere has is very bright in the daytime. There's a lot of scattered light in the atmosphere. The sunlight comes in, and because we have our atmosphere, you have light all over the place, and the sky looks blue. That blue color is light that's coming from the atmosphere itself. You're seeing the blue atmosphere all around Earth. That's what the blue sky is. If it weren't for the atmosphere, you just see the sun in the sky, and everything else would be black. If you were on the moon, no atmosphere, you would see the sun in the sky and black with stars. That's what you would actually see on the moon, because there's no atmosphere. On Earth, you see a blue sky. Why is it a blue sky when the sun is out? Because the light is reflected and regenerated out of our own atmosphere. And so it looks blue. That's the color of our atmosphere. If you look from outer space and you look at Earth, you see that blue layer above Earth. That's our atmosphere. On the night side, it looks black because there's no sunlight hitting the atmosphere. So the point is that there is a lot of light, native light, let's call it, in the atmosphere. And so the comet, the light from the comet would be drowned out, but you'd still be able to see the comet, that cloud up there, especially when it's a big comet, it's bright and it's close. Like I said, I observed Hale-Bopp almost into daylight when I was looking at it when it was here in the solar system in the late 1990s. So the pillar of day by the pillar of smoke by day and the stick of light by night is a perfect explanation of the plasma discharge comet model. Standard science tells you that none of this happens. They deny our history. So they deny the scientific basis for our history. They deny everything about our history. Why? They want to keep you from understanding this. First of all, if you don't understand your history, you can't tell what's going to happen in the future. Dumbing down the public is numero uno, number one, biggest thing that they are doing today. The only way they can maintain control of the public. Control of the public has always been a maintenance issue of control of information. So if they can keep people stupid, they can control people. It's as simple as that. So that's a great question. The person that is calling, like I said, I love listener questions. They allow me to get into the topic and their question. Then many people are thinking that. I always said in the classroom, there's no stupid question because it shows that the first thing that's being discussed is upon. So that was a wonderful question because it really allows you to see through the eyes of they did and what they did understand that they were out there. They didn't understand that the effects of the Moses event. They didn't know what comets were, but they were thousands of years later. We can go back and examine what they saw and interpret it, but you need correct information of the solar system works to do this. Okay, I'm going to spend the last couple minutes just reviewing the CD. Excuse me. The basis of the CDs that have just came out. My 2 CD set. It's my latest release. 18 hours of the physics of planets and celestial disaster. I know a lot of people already have that, but really with information in the psychology of Planet X. There's 4 hours of lectures simply on psychology of Planet X. How do we view it from the human side, from standard astronomy, and Kowalski so ridiculed? And who else has an interest in this? Who's putting the money behind standard science, tier two science, to keep it going? It wouldn't keep going on its own. It's just some fluff that would blow away in the wind overnight if it weren't for some people putting serious money. And so let's go back to the Queen, the Rothschilds, the bankers, world control. The world control of money, world control of oil, of water, of resources. How can all of this happen in the modern world? Well, you got to keep people real stupid, and they're doing a good job of that. If you look at the general public out there, I hate to say it, but there's not a lot of thought going on out there today. So that's why my audience is a very special group. They're the people who are thinking. And all I can say is that if you go out and try and talk to people on the street, you're going to get a lot of blank stares. That's all I can tell you, a lot of blank stares. So make sure you, if you haven't already gotten it, get a copy of the 2-CD set, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Catastrophes, and also the books. It's interesting, the books are selling as good today as they were when they first came out. So I think that says something about the information in those books. They were written for all time, not just for a 1 year period or something. So this is Jim McCanny, this is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.